afternoon and welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. Have you ever been told that your proclivity towards melancholia is biochemical or genetic in nature, and that only medication can correct this imbalance? How much scientific evidence do doctors have for this type of diagnosis, and how much evidence is there for an idea that a drug that alters brain activity can do so without having a disruptive effect on the delicate balance required for efficient brain functioning? Today, we'll examine the scientific research as we question the efficacy of using psychiatric medications. I'm joined by phone by psychiatrist Peter Bregan, whose new book, which is co-written by Dr. David Cohen, is called Your Drug May Be Your Problem. Stay with us as we discuss how and why to stop taking psychiatric medications. We'll also discuss why someone might be tempted to do it, and we'll go over, you know, some considerations. We'll discuss those as well. I'll also try to weave in some nutritional information about what sorts of deficiencies can affect both the function of the brain and which measures may protect us from the development of psychiatric symptoms. Wolfel and raising Dr. Bregan. Oh, okay. Great. Dr. Bregan, are you with us?
I am with you.
Oh, goody. Let me just give you an introduction here.
Okay, we on the air?
Yes, we are indeed.
Hello.
Peter Bregan, MD, has become internationally known. He's a psychiatrist and author of a dozen books, including Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Talking Back to Ritalin. He's the international director of the Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology, which he founded in the early 70s. His background, Dr. Bregan was trained at Harvard College and Case Western Reserve Medical School. He took his residency in psychiatry at the Massachusetts Medical Center and the State University of New York Upstate Medical Center. He's former full-time consultant with the National Institute of Medical Health and has held teaching appointments at Harvard Medical School, the Washington School of Psychiatry, University, and Johns Hopkins University. He lives in Bethesda, Maryland, where he has a psychiatric practice, although I suspect rather strongly that it doesn't include the use of psychiatric drugs. Before we get into our topic of discussing whether or not psychiatric drugs are, whether there's efficacy in using them, why don't you explain what studies you looked at to support your suspicions about their dangers and ineffectiveness?
Sure, Lane, and let me say that I do have the brand new book out, which really covers all the psychiatric drugs, and that book is called Your Drug May Be Your Problem.
Right.
And the subtitle, How and Why to Stop Taking Psychiatric Medications. And in all of my books, I review the psychiatric literature, the medical literature, in far greater depth than your average textbook, right? Really almost than any textbooks of psychiatry or medicine. I'll have hundreds of citations, but they may have dozens. And also, as a medical expert in legal cases, I've had the opportunity to do something that very few psychiatrists ever have, which is I actually get inside the drug companies to see how they operate, how they think, the kinds of data they hide, the kinds of data they let out. So I'm drawing in my books on often, really, in a sense, secret data that I'm making public and documenting, and then tons of scientific studies, and then my clinical practice. You know, I've been in practice now for 30 years or more, really. I went into practice in 1968. I'm 63 years old now. I've been doing this for 30 or more years. So I bring together a lot of different things to view the dangers of psychiatric drugs, and also now in the new book, the dangers of coming off of them, because all psychiatric drugs potentially have withdrawal effects, and some of the withdrawal effects can be very serious, even psychosis and coming off some psychiatric drugs.
Well, we'll get into that. But going back to the issue of the studies, what you're telling me, I think what I just understood you to say, is that you have access to studies that other people do not have access to because of why?
Well, for a few different reasons. For one thing, I actually do have the opportunity to see materials developed in the Food and Drug Administration and the FDA and by drug companies that other people don't get any access to. And I've tried to write about them extensively for that reason. And I get access to them because in lawsuits against the drug companies, they are often forced to produce materials that they have not wanted to otherwise produce. And whenever I use that material, I cite the exact documents. But also, I have made a life's work of looking into the literature on psychiatric drugs and putting together things that have been missed routinely by many of the people who write on the subject. See, most people who write about psychiatric drugs are drug advocates. I mean, if you go into your local bookstore and you pick up a book on Prozac or a book on psychiatric drugs, unless it's one of my books, it's most likely by a person who's getting lots of money from psychiatric drug companies. They may be involved with multiple drug companies. If you get a book by Barclay, for example, who is a big advocate of Ritalin for children, you're not going to know this, but he has, you know, had to state in other documents I've gotten a hold of, you know, that he is conflict of interest in terms of taking money one way or another from five or six drug companies. So this is a common phenomena. What the public tends to get is a drug company filtered, prepared, pureed version of what psychiatric drugs are about. And I try to give a version that really looks at the dangers of putting these substances into our brains and then the dangers of stopping taking them and how to stop taking them okay. The safest way.
Essentially, what you also mentioned in the book, which it doesn't shock or surprise me, is that, of course, studies are paid for by pharmaceutical companies. Studies are very, very expensive to do, and they tend to be supported and paid for by the companies that make the drugs. And in addition to that, you mentioned the fact that doctors receive incentives for taking sort of, educational seminars produced by the drug companies discussing the use of these drugs. They receive continuing medical education credits. Right. Sometimes they get money for doing this. So there's a big push. Now, what might
Even
be interesting...
journals, by the way, Lena, the New York Times just had an article, I think today, by Altman, the physician Lawrence Altman, about how the journals are now big money makers because of the money they get from drug company advertising. And in my experience, that really does control the kinds of things they will publish. The journals making so much money, so closely involved with the drug companies, don't want to publish articles that are going to offend them.
Well, and there's just a financial issue, too. Who's going to have the money to put up for these studies? Now,
Let's
unpack the studies that have been done that are convincing doctors that they should use these drugs. How are these studies done? What is it that they do in these studies that are supposed to make it seem safe or efficacious to use these drugs?
Well, first of all, Lena, let's not kid ourselves into thinking that the studies are what convince the doctors. Your average pediatrician who's giving Ritalin to children, your average psychiatrist or internist or even surgeon nowadays who's giving Prozac or Zoloft or Xanax to their patients does not read studies. They just don't have the time. It takes somebody like me who actually sort of made an avocation and a profession of it to read the studies. Now, the studies themselves, however, are almost always dreadfully flawed. One of the ways they're flawed is that they're usually only 4 to 6 weeks long. So when Prozac was approved by the FDA, the average length of study was about 5 weeks. Well, what in the world can you learn about a drug by examining its dangerous effects in a 5-week period? Even so, many patients stopped taking Prozac in those 5 weeks because it was so harmful to them. So what the FDA allowed people to do, the company to do, was be to use statistics that made believe the people had kept taking the drug. So let's say after 3 weeks on the drug, you were judged by the doctor to be doing better, but you didn't show up for the 4th week or the 5th week. You dropped out. Literally, the company was allowed to count that person who dropped out in terms of their having improved, even though they quit a drug. So, obviously, almost always because of adverse, negative, harmful effects.
Well, and it also means that we now don't know what the long-term effects really are,
well,
because we don't
right.
have studies to support that. But
let me give you a good example of that, Lena. you know, initially a drug like Prozac will cause weight loss. So it was being pushed for women on the grounds, look, this antidepressant will help you lose weight. But see, the brain doesn't treat the drug that way. The brain fights the drug. Now we're getting a lot of evidence that people get pathological obesity, overweight, on the long term from taking the drugs because the brain is fighting against that initial tendency of the drug to suppress appetite.
One of the things that you take to task in this book is the idea, which has been really pushed among people, and I'm sure that people with a very unfortunate and very what appear to be very serious diagnosis, like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, what they're told is that their brain has an imbalance, a biochemical imbalance, and that that what's going to happen is they have this little genetic thing, and this drug is going to come in and it's going to correct the imbalance. Why don't you explain what's wrong with this concept?
Well, for one, it's fake. It's made up by the drug companies. And as each new drug comes out, the companies pay for lots of seminars, pay for lots of publications that will claim that there's a biochemical imbalance.
How do we know that it's fake?
Because there's no evidence for it, and because you can actually watch the advertising campaign develop. For example, before Prozac was even approved by the FDA, the drug company that makes it, Eli Lilly, was paying doctors to go to seminars to discuss how the particular imbalance was one that Prozac was fixing. Now we have another antidepressants coming out that affect different neurotransmitters. So again, the drug companies are paying for these huge advertising campaigns to try to link depression no longer to serotonin, but now to norepinephrine. The names don't matter. It's that each new drug is touted in a fake way. And we also know that these drugs have the same effect on normal animals, normal people, and people who are anxious, sad, depressed, or whatever. For example, lithium was discovered by giving it to animals, and it flaked out the animals, made them stuporous, so the doctor just went next door and gave them to the patients in the mental hospital, and it subdued them and quieted them down just like it did the animals. Only later does the fake claim made to promote the drug to say that there's an imbalance that's being affected. We don't even have a tool that would enable us to go into the brain to check the balance of these neurochemicals in those tiny spaces where they are active, which are called synapses.
Right.
We don't have any measurement for that. It's all made up.
What's interesting here is that it does appear from the studies that I've done studying nutritional effects in the case of psychiatric disruption or symptoms, symptomatology, that certain nutritional deficiencies, endocrinologic deficiencies or excesses, too many sex hormones, too little sex hormones, not enough thyroid, too much thyroid, or, as we say, a deficiency of some of these neurotransmitters that we produce in our bodies, like serotonin, norepinephrine, the dopamine, the various things, but that these things can be influenced by using amino acid therapy, by changing the diet of the patient. Some of these things are caused by food allergies. And you talk about the fact that there's a lack of a sort of systems analysis approach
right.
to looking at depression, psychiatric symptoms. What they're saying essentially is you don't have enough serotonin. So rather than looking at why you might not have enough serotonin or how to help your body to produce more or utilize it better, they introduce a drug which has a forced effect on the brain. Now, what you're concerned with, let me just quickly say for those of you who are just tuning in, what you're listening to is your own health and fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I have on the phone Peter Bragan, MD, who is the author of his newest book called Your Drug May Be Your Problem, How and Why to Stop Taking Psychiatric Medications. Anyway, just that what they're saying is that you've been concerned about the way in which the drug forces something to occur instead of supporting its production. It sort of forces something. So how does that happen, and what's wrong with that scenario?
Well, all psychiatric drugs create severe imbalances in the brain, and it's those imbalances that flatten our feelings or that give us an artificial high. But I'd like to make a distinction and perhaps disagree with you on the edges of something. I don't think we should lump together known disorders like hypothyroid hormonal disorders or estrogen imbalances in women at times. those are known factors. We can measure those. There are blood tests for them. We know that changes in these hormones affect our moods and emotions, and we know that correcting them with estrogen or correcting it with a thyroid supplement can really affect mood tremendously. But when you get then to the next jump of the biochemicals in the brain, like dopamine or norepinephrine or serotonin, that's made up. We don't know that. Now, some people will benefit from nutritional supplements that affect those neurotransmitters, but we don't have good, clean studies to show there was anything wrong there or that there's a real scientific evidence for the nutritional supplement. However, I'm happy to have people use nutritional supplements. I use them sometimes because I know if I know they're relatively harmless and if I know that they may play a role in this aging body and helping it along, but it's not necessarily based on real good science.
Well, there is recently, I should have brought this study in with me. I apologize for not having it to cite.
But we don't
you,
need
but,
to.
Wait, let me just get through this. There has been very compelling evidence recently, and we don't know, you're right, we don't know the mechanism, that omega-3 fatty acid deficiency has a profound effect on people with extreme psychiatric disturbances like schizophrenic psychosis. And even the AMA has started to recognize this as being so. So, but, you know, it brings up a question of, your book advocates mostly the use of psychiatric therapy or psychological therapy, mostly the use of...
Well, that's just what I do.
Well, no. I agree with you that these things are not a single, it's not a single bullet. That's a bad metaphor, but that it's not one thing, that it's a myriad of things that need to be looked at. The thing that I'm bringing up is, regardless of whether or not we know from scientific research, which is, we've just acknowledged, is done primarily by the pharmaceutical companies, why somebody, we don't know why someone experiences a psychosis or extreme symptoms that affect their quality of life. But this business of not looking to see what the cause is, the
right.
number of people who show up with depression and are simply handed a pill instead of
right.
breaking it down and looking at the component parts is what I'm addressing.
Well, absolutely. And then aren't told, first, that there are many serious symptoms from these drugs. Many drugs can even contribute to psychosis or violence. A lot of the school shooters, for example, Lane, have been taking psychiatric drugs. Ritalin was being given to Kip Kinkle in Oregon and to T.J. Solomon in Conyers, Georgia, and Eric Harris, who did the shootings in Littleton, was on Luvox, which is a Prozac-like drug. All of those drugs can cause psychosis. We know that. We have data that show that the amphetamines, the stimulants, and the antidepressants can all cause psychosis, and patients aren't warned. So what I've been trying to do in my work is inform, warn people what the dangers are that they're not going to hear routinely from their doctor, and I try to cover all the drugs in your drug may be a problem, all the classes of drugs, and then what happens when you stop? Because that brain that's been revved up and pushed around by drugs, or as you put it aptly, forced by drugs in one direction or another, now reacts on its own without the drug as you try to come off. And again, you can go through all kinds of despair and anguish and discomfort. Depending on the particular drug, it may differ from drug to drug. You can go through these terrible reactions and get very confused. Your doctor will say, see, you need the drug. That's like telling an alcoholic you need the drug when they've stopped and they're going into the DTs. That is not what's going on.
No,
you need a different, gentler withdrawal from the drug.
Absolutely. What this sort of speaks to, too, what we do know from the wonderful research by Candace Pert, who I think has a little, is included, has a little testimonial toward your book.
It's a lovely testimonial
right.
for the book.
Right.
Yeah.
But what she did is she identified the opiate receptor, and what she helped us to understand is this business of upregulation and downregulation of receptor sites. And one of the concerns that you mentioned in the book is this business of causing an addiction by adding in or forcing the system that creates these or reuses these neurotransmitters in the brain instead of creating them from the inside, which we can do. And then there's a dependence or a dulling of the system so that the individual can't make these things on their own. So essentially what happens when you withdraw the drug or when you take the drug is that you begin to develop the very symptoms you were being treated for, even if they were, they even become, can become more severe. So that's one of the things that gets dicey. Here. The part that's tricky, and I have had on my show, for instance, an example is I did interview a psychiatrist who wrote a book about OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and he himself, who is a believer in therapeutic medicine, he's not just a drug psychiatrist, he's somebody who believes in therapy, went himself through an awful lot before he found a drug which now seems to be maintaining him in a way that's working. So his book is very compelling, even though I did bring in the issue of these other, you know, other diagnostic tools and other things. There are many, many people who are not adverse to doing therapy, who have been through therapy and forever and continue to have extremely disruptive symptoms that make their lives almost impossible to live. These are often, I mean, there are people who are just sort of going into their office feeling crummy and getting a drug, but there are also people who have spent their whole lives with disruptive symptoms that make it impossible for them to live and finally break down and go through this experience of trying different drugs until they find one, and sometimes they do find something. And we're talking about symptoms that absolutely disrupt their lives and the people around them. Now, so I'm just thinking, what about the people who fall through the cracks, who are helped by psychiatric drugs? I'm not an advocate of psychiatric drugs. Don't misunderstand.
Right. Well, and I'm not saying that people shouldn't take a substance if they want to. There are people who feel helped by so many different substances. We act like it's a, you know, that when somebody thinks they're helped by Prozac, let's say, or their life has been changed by Prozac, that is some sort of scientific evidence. I have a friend. I can give you another story. A friend of mine who's a psychiatrist who smoked dope every night for years and years and years and told me how wonderful it was and how it cooled him out and all that. But his wife told me she couldn't relate to him. Did that.
No, I know. People don't really know what they're like when they're high.
Right. People, and they really don't know what they're like when they're on psychiatric drugs, if they're having a psychoactive effect. Often people who are taking a drug, whether it's marijuana, alcohol, or Prozac, are the last to know. I've had people come to me in my practice who have been written up in books previously as wonderful cures on drugs, who now come, the drug effect is worn off, their brain has been harmed, they're feeling the negative effects on, you know, a year later, or their wives or husbands are bringing them in and saying, this person isn't able to love, isn't able to relate anymore. You know, life is complicated and difficult. I leave it up to people, provided they're informed. My view of life is that it's fundamentally about how we relate to ourselves, to other human beings, to God, to nature, to our ideals and our principles, and that we should not give up that viewpoint when the suffering seems overwhelming and confusing and demoralizing. We should just try again through new relationships, new understandings, new work to find our way in this world. That's what I believe.
Well,
it doesn't have to be what everyone.
I understand. And you also do mention in the book, and you do have a study to support this, that therapy has been shown to be more effective than drugs in treating people who have their first schizophrenic psychotic break. And that's very encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, and very dramatic. And it was in California, Soteria House, Lauren Mosier developed this study, and he showed that people who go to a residential home-like environment and receive therapeutic support from caring, open-minded people, none of whom were professionals, that when they tried to pick the most open-minded, caring, non-coercive people, they ended up not picking professionals. And that they did wonderful work with people who had severe psychotic breaks. And it was a controlled scientific study because other people were randomly sent to the mental hospitals. And the people tended to do better, and they didn't get horrible neurological drug effects from going through the Soteria House project, in which the vast majority got no drugs at all. What happens, though, is that psychiatry then comes down hard on you, and Lauren Mosier has suffered the slings and arrows of outraged psychiatry, as I have and as many others in the field have, for showing that the psychological, the social approach to human beings is a better one.
In addition to that, as I mentioned before, Claire Felix, who's been on the show a lot, who's a nutritional journalist, is editing a book right now that was written by a psychiatric nurse who had schizophrenic psychotic breaks throughout most of her life and eventually was treated for an omega-3 fatty acid deficiency and is literally cured and has written this book as a way of letting people know that this is a possible thing. So I think that one really ought to exhaust all the other possibilities, and we can discuss that more after we take a brief break. I want to break for about 30 seconds in just a moment. I want to remind people that I'm talking to Dr. Peter Bragan, who is a psychiatrist who is critical of psychiatric medications, and his newest book is Your Drug May Be Your Problem, How and Why to Stop Taking Psychiatric Medications. We're going to break for about 30 seconds. When we come back, we're going to continue to discuss the other factors that may underlie a psychiatric diagnosis, what to do when you get a frightening psychiatric diagnosis, and how to withdraw from drugs. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman. We'll be back in 30 seconds. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm on the phone with Dr. Peter Bragan, MD, psychiatrist and critic of psychiatric medications. He's written and published many, many books. The newest one is called Your Drug May Be Your Problem, How and Why to Stop Taking Psychiatric Medications. This book is published by Perseus, P-E-R-S-E-U-S, Books. It's a new book. So if you have trouble finding it in the stores, you can certainly ask your bookstore to look for it for you.
It should be in all the stores now, and it's also on Amazon.com.
There you go. Okay. Now, one of the things that I was bringing up is that I would like just, let me also just remind people that if you miss parts of today's show and you decide that you'd like to get a cassette copy of today's show, or if you need more information about the show in general, you can call my information number at 707-773-4727, or you can go to the website for the show. You delete www and type in members.aol.com/, and then the initials of the show, Y-O-H-A-F, Yohaf. I think, Dr. Bragan, don't you also have a internet site?
It's Bragan.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N. www.bragan.com.
Okay.
Got a lot of stuff on it. My wife, Ginger, keeps that updated, lots of information on it.
If you'll indulge me for just a second, I would like to just go over, I know that you're a strong advocate of therapy. I also believe very strongly in therapy, but I'm also someone who believes very strongly in nutritional and hormonal balances. So just a couple of reminders that, as we mentioned, any kind of endocrinologic or hormonal imbalance can cause depression. The health of the gut can cause depression. That means that food allergies and addictions, environmental sensitivities, nutritional deficiencies can cause depression. Chronic stress can cause depression. And the allergy thing is very tricky also, because there are things like grain allergies, which specifically have as a symptom a sort of unconsolable depression. So it can be very simple in certain cases. And individuals who have multiple chemical and inhalant allergies often suffer depression and anxiety when they're exposed to an offending substance. And then we've discussed the omega-3 fats. So there's also light therapy for people who are very sensitive to light. So there are a number of things that can be checked out before you take a psychiatric medication. The reason that we're concerned about them, among other things, is, for an example, the JAMA study that you cite in your book that concluded that the frequency of fatal reactions to prescribed drugs in the United States ranks them either fourth or sixth as a leading cause of death behind heart disease, cancer, and strokes. We don't usually hear this from supplementing with omega-3 fats and things like that. The dangers of long-term use, these drugs were not tested with the intention of them being used this long, and some of the most popular medications, like Prozac, as we've been mentioning, seem to have this effect of dulling the mechanisms for producing the very thing they're trying to make you have access to, serotonin. There are other concerns for our children, which you've written a lot about, for instance, the growth hormone inhibition with Ritalin. And I guess this brings up the question of how should we be caring for and protecting our children. I'm sure that you want to mention that. I wonder also if we're in danger of damaging our genes with these medications.
Well, the children are, of course, as you said, a major concern of mine. And I have a whole chapter in the book on how to withdraw children from psychiatric drugs. We're really giving our kids drugs that damage the brain. There is no question that Ritalin and the amphetamines, which are Adderall and Dazoxin and Dexedrine and so on, that these drugs actually can permanently change the brain. We know with amphetamine in clinical doses, which is Dexedrine and Adderall, cells die in animals. We know that. Now, the pediatricians don't necessarily know that, but I've reviewed that literature, and a scientific presenter at the National Institutes of Health, I presented that literature. There was nobody there to contradict it because it's, you know, it's scientific literature. It's and it's on the mark. It's animal work. It's not very difficult to do in terms of getting it right. And as you mentioned, all of the stimulants disrupt growth hormone. Parents see their kids getting skinny and not growing as well on these drugs, and they think it's because the drugs suppress appetite. That's just the beginning of the problem. The drugs literally cause malfunction in growth hormone. That means the brain, the liver, the lungs. It means the whole body.
Well, and this is a developing brain. This is a developing brain.
That's right. It's the developing brain. And I just don't think we should be giving any of these drugs, Prozac or any of these drugs, to the developing brains of our kids. And besides, almost everything that we see in our children that is distressing can be viewed much better in terms of our being in conflict with our kids. They're not adjusting to our schools. They're not being respectful in the families. They're out of control. They're not performing the way we want them to perform. These are conflicts between adults and children. And it's up to us as adults not to diagnose and drug the child to say this kid who looks out of control has got hyperactivity or something. What we need to do is say we're not meeting our kids' needs. And those needs are very broad. You've been addressing nutritional needs. A lot of our kids are going to school hungry or full of junk food. We need to address their general health needs. Some of these kids are sick. They don't have, quote, ADHD, which is a made-up thing, but they may have a hormonal disorder.
There's another thing that happens with young children. I had this happen. Somebody came into my practice with a child who, out of nowhere, started to develop obsessive-compulsive disorder symptoms. And she came in, and she looked... It was very small. It was like a seven-year-old, and she looked really terrible. She was very pale, and sort of her skin was gray, and her eyes were not focusing. She wasn't tracking. She was very easily excited and agitated. She was afraid of eating food in most places. And I had her and her mom go out in the backyard, and I talked to her grandmother, who brought her in. And one of the things that I discovered in the literature and also from talking to other people is this issue of heavy metal contamination or exposure to molds or things in the environments in the schools sometimes, or pesticide. Sometimes children are exposed to toxic substances, and it will suddenly, they'll get these very aberrant symptoms all over the place, all of a sudden like this. So there are a number of things that need to be looked at when a child is developing symptoms.
Well, absolutely. And what I advise to parents is first, make your own assessment. Is your child a problem at home? And if so, what sort of problem? If the problem is just at school, the kid's not achieving, not doing the things that the school wants them to do or that you want them to do, that's not a disease. That's not doing well in school. And that's how it should be looked upon. And that can be a matter of teaching. It can be a matter of the child's own development. It can be a matter of almost anything, including on occasion some sort of environmental problem the child's having, or maybe just not having the right eyeglasses.
Yes.
Could be many, many different things, but it's not attention deficit disorder. That's made up as an umbrella explanation that doesn't involve really looking at the child. Now, most of the kids that I see in my practice here in Bethesda, their problems are fairly straightforward. It's either one or the other, or a combination of the parents haven't figured out how to really relate to and properly raise and discipline the child, or if they're doing pretty good at that and there are problems at school, the school hasn't figured out how to address the child's educational needs. The most important thing for children in this country is for us to be concerned about what are their basic needs and how we can address them rather than our diagnosing and drugging them.
Well, this brings up another issue as we approach, and I promise we will discuss this thing of how to withdraw from medications.
Well, it's which, in the book, too.
Yes, no, of course. Right, of course.
But go ahead.
But this isn't just a commercial for the book. We also want to give people some practical information here on the air.
Give as much as I can.
I know you will. When a person receives a psychiatric diagnosis, a serious psychiatric diagnosis, or a parent receives such a diagnosis for the child, they are, in effect, feeling as though they've been, quote, let off the hook emotionally for what's going on. Now, I've already said that there may be health considerations to look at as well. So it may not be that you have to proceed by feeling like you're a bad person. It isn't that black and white. But it's very hard to know what to do when you're given this sort of very, very compelling diagnosis. You are bipolar. You are schizophrenic. Your child has ADD. How do you recommend that people weather having a critical diagnosis like this? What is it, the first thing that you think that people ought to do? I mean, we've discussed the fact that it's very hard for people who are taking psychiatric medications to assess whether or not the medication is good for them because they're impaired. But if you're having really severe symptoms, you're under a lot of stress. How do you assess this situation? What do you do? What kind of support should you look for?
Well, I think the first thing is not to believe in psychiatric diagnoses, not to believe that they're giving you some sort of important scientific fact. When the doctor says to you, you're clinically depressed, that's not a scientific fact. There is no such thing as a difference between being very unhappy and being clinically depressed. It's just a way of selling the psychiatric drug. The doctor always connects clinical depression to selling, giving you the drug. So, or if the doctor tells you have a biochemical imbalance, one of my friends pointed out, one of my colleagues, that the biochemical imbalance is the only disease that's spread by word of mouth. The doctor tells you got a biochemical imbalance, or the newspaper tells you. So get rid of the idea that somebody pronouncing a diagnosis on you contains some important factual matter. The real question is, what are you suffering yourself as a human being? Well, what is the distress in your child? What is actually going on in you as an individual? What is actually happening to your child as an individual? If you're depressed, I mean, there are basic things you want to think about. How long have you been depressed? Is it lifelong, in which case it probably goes back to childhood? Is it sudden onset and there's nothing in your life to account for it? Maybe you do have a physical illness. All kinds of physical illnesses can first show themselves as being depressed, but not this mythical biochemical imbalance. So you need to think a lot about yourself. And did you become depressed with the new job? Or did you become depressed when your husband or wife left you or died? What's going on in your life? What's the pattern? Some people get depressed whenever they get a bad cold because they're so high energy they can't bear to have their energy knocked out. So it's a matter of, there's no shortcut to really looking at your life, at your whole health history. One of the things that I see a lot in my practice is women who have clearly hypothyroid disorder, and their psychiatrists have never even asked them simple questions like, has your skin texture changed? Is your hair falling out or growing more thickly? Have you gained weight, lost weight? Do you feel palpitations in your chest from your heart beating irregularly? Have your bowels changed in the way they're operating? And on a number of occasions, it's been clear to me that what was needed was an endocrinology consult, and instead of dismissing the woman's problem as, quote, depression, a biochemical imbalance. So if you reject the psychiatric nonsense that my colleagues in psychiatry are putting out and look at yourself as a human being, that there's no 15-minute diagnosis and then take a drug for the rest of your life, it's a matter of understanding yourself and taking care of your health for the rest of your life.
There are psychotherapists who are committed to the use of therapy and psychotherapy and therapy for helping people to be strong and empowered and in control of their lives, etc. And you know, sort of turning around, healing bad scripts from their childhood or whatever, who still say, particularly I'm thinking also of people who have discussed the issue of men's psychiatric disturbances, that often, because it is so devastating to a man to be, quote, out of control, that the use, the temporary use or the short-term use of a psychiatric drug is supposed to help them get at difficult things in therapy. You say nay. You say this is not so.
Well, first of all, the, quote, short-term use of psychiatric drugs almost doesn't exist anymore unless it's just changing you from one drug to another, so you have the short-term use of one particular drug. And there's a reason for that, and that's because the drugs cause withdrawal problems and people suffer. They're on a drug for 6 or 8 or 10 weeks, and they come off. They often go through a suffering, and they return to the drug or they get a new drug to handle the withdrawal. The other is, I mean, you've got clear-cut men's issues. What a dreadful thing to communicate to a man or a woman that they have culturally learned gender issues that they can't personally control, so will drug you. It, first of all, doesn't make a lot of sense. Secondly, it's a bad message. But there's another issue here, Elena, which therapists don't face. Typically what happens is the person is depressed, they come to the therapist, or anxious, they work at therapy for a while, and it doesn't work. Now, what does the therapist do? Now, the therapist could say, I'm a bad therapist, I'll take a drug. Or, I was the right therapist for you, I'll take a drug. That never happens. It's always, you're not the right patient,
right.
You take a drug.
That's right.
And what I tell therapists is that, listen, it is just arrogant to say that because somebody isn't being helped in your therapy that they need a drug. That's like going out on a date with somebody and using a roofie because they don't want to have sex with you.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
It is very similar. It's saying the problem is you, not me, mm-hmm. not our relationship. And there are many people I'm not going to help in therapy that somebody else is going to help. And there are many people I'm helping who somebody else didn't help. Relationship is complicated. Knowledge is complicated. The spiritual chemistry of therapy is complicated. And there are times when therapy is just not the right approach, that something else is going to help a human being far more. It is arrogant to say because, quote, therapy didn't work, you should take a drug.
In addition, what you point out in your book, is, which is something I've observed also in people that I talk to, is that, in fact, the medication tends to dull their reaction on an emotional level, which makes therapy rather ineffective as well.
Yes, I think it says something about therapists. If they say they can communicate better with their patient after the patient's on a drug, I think it says more about the therapist than the poor, unhappy patient. I don't find that people being drugged makes it better to communicate with them. I find that that deep, painful, confusing emotion can be related to and communicated with, and that I feel much more in the presence of the human being and much more able to work on helping their life than if they are flattened by a drug.
Yeah, well, and I think it's also important to remind people that those experiences in therapy, although they are rather difficult, I don't know how to say this, they're productive. It's a little bit like having a terrible cough and suppressing the expectorant quality of the coughing so that you can never effectively use what's going on. It's you do need to sometimes experience these feelings, not endlessly because they're good for you, but because they're there. And often when you make a connection in therapy, it reduces the profound effect that it's had on your present life.
I really do want to, Elena, just say again, and I think you're well aware of this, I'm not saying that this is a contest between drugs and psychotherapy or drugs and Peter Breggin's form of psychotherapy. I'm saying the issue is drugs versus all the things in the world
things
can have.
Yes, that help them. Yeah, I think that's a very important distinction. Let's talk about withdrawal. And why don't you give people some considerations on what they should think about and prepare for if they're going to try to withdraw, and what kind of support they should get?
Well, depending on the drug, as short as 4 or 5 weeks on a drug can start to cause withdrawal problems. And in fact, Ritalin, which we give to children, causes withdrawal problems on the first dose. We have scientific studies showing that a normal child or any child given one dose of Ritalin is going to go through a withdrawal called rebound, and the child may become the opposite of what the drug did. So if the drug spaced out the child, calmed the child, made the child docile, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours later, you're going to have a more hyper-aggressive, agitated child on your hands. And these studies have been published in top journals, just nobody pays any, unfortunately, very few people at least pay any attention to them. A good thumbnail is that the brain tries to overcome the drug effect. Going back to our alcohol analogy, if you drink alcohol to go to sleep at 10 p.m., your brain is likely to wake you up 5 hours later even more insomniac and hyper than you were because the brain is fighting the alcohol effect. So the alcohol will initially put you to sleep, but then your brain fights back. So the drug will tend to cause the brain to go in the opposite direction. So if you're taking Xanax or Valium or Klonopin for several weeks or worse for months, you may be getting a sedation effect for a few hours, and then on the very same day as the drug withdrawal takes place, you may get more anxious and more hyper and get very confused. You think, oh my God, I really need this drug. Look how anxious I'm getting without it. And then if you try to come off the drug, if you've been on particularly sedative kinds of drugs, anti-anxiety kinds of drugs, if you've been on them for a long time in high doses, your brain may be so revved up fighting the drug that you could have seizures as you come off the drug. Now, this is even true, this general principle with lithium, which many doctors don't realize. We have now got a number of studies that show that if you have had a tendency to have these extreme high experiences where you're really out of control, your judgment's impaired, your mind's going a mile a minute, it's called mania, you put on lithium. When you come off lithium, your odds are increased in the next weeks and few months for having a manic episode. The rate goes up. It's a withdrawal phenomena. Then what happens is the doctor says, see, you need lithium. As soon as you're off your lithium, you get crazy again, or you get high again, or manic again. But in fact, a lot of it is withdrawal, an increased rate of mania as you try to come off your lithium. People who try to come off the neuroleptic drugs, so-called antipsychotic drugs like Risperdal and Haldol and Thorazine and Prolixin and newer ones like Zyprexa and so on, those drugs which are used to control psychosis and suppress psychosis, we know there are rebound psychoses that can even become permanent from those drugs. And just as those drugs suppress you and put you in a straitjacket where you can't move, the body fights back and you can end up with permanent neurological hyperactivities, out-of-control activities of your neurological system. Now, I'm being a little bit metaphorical and just trying to get this across with this basic idea, but it's a good thumbnail that, in general, look out for the opposite. I was working with a patient who was on Zoloft, an antidepressant given by another doctor. She cut her antidepressant in half one night without telling anybody. Suicidally depressed in a matter of hours. That's withdrawal. In general, if you're having a really painful emotional reaction within days or weeks of coming off a drug, it's very likely withdrawal. Not necessarily, but very likely withdrawal rather than your own emotional problems. And it's very important during withdrawal to go slow.
Now, when you say slow, you mean much slower than anybody who goes slow goes. So explain that.
We do mean slower. David Cohen, my co-author, and I, we do mean slower than most people mean. In part, it's important to, when you're describing in a book how to go about things, to make sure that people are being as careful as possible, and we are trying to be as careful as possible. But if you've been on a drug for years, you probably are going to take months to come off.
That's very important to remember.
And doctors will take people off in a day, 2 days, 4 days. They'll call that a withdrawal, a tapered withdrawal. It varies a lot, but keep in mind that if it's a sedative drug in particular, a drug that hits you like alcohol, like Xanax and Klonopin, that you might even need a detox center to come off if you've been on for months or years. And it does vary from drug to drug.
How should you decide whether or not you need a professional of some sort or another to help you with this process? How do you make that decision?
Well, if you've been on a drug for more than a few weeks, you need to have some information about the problems of coming off the drug. And that can even be true with medical, certain just medical drugs. For example, if you're on a drug that suppresses hypertension, you can get a rebound hypertension when you come off the drug. Clonidine is a drug that's given to children to sedate them. It's actually antihypertensive. If you stop it immediately, you can get a hypertensive crisis. So there isn't any easy thing. You've got to actually find out about the drug you're on to know whether and what the hazards are. And there's sources for doing that, not just my book, sometimes on the internet, sometimes other medical books. And if you can find a doctor who's going to be straight with you, which is not necessarily easy, and you press the doctor to really give you the information and maybe even to help you find a book that deals with it, that's the best thing to do. But I mean, I haven't been able to say this, and I haven't said this about any of our other books. This is the only book that really gives you that cross-section of information about the basic kinds of dangers in withdrawing from all the categories of drugs. And even one book is probably not going to be enough.
It's called Your Drug May Be Your Problem, How and Why to Stop Taking Psychiatric Medications. The person that wrote the book, along with his co-author David Cohen, is who we're speaking to, Peter Bragan, who is a psychiatrist. You urge often for people even to seek out a psychologist or somebody who can do some therapeutic work to help over the emotional roller coaster of making this withdrawal. You also use...
I also recommend, by the way, let me quickly, the people let their best friends know. Let your husband, your wife, your best friend know that you are coming off psychiatric drugs and ask them to help keep an eye on you, because they will see things that you won't see and you won't even be able to tell the psychiatrist because... or your professional, because you won't know you're getting more irritable, more angry.
That's right.
So it's important to let somebody you care about and trust know when you're coming off of psychiatric drugs.
Why don't you just very briefly describe the 10% method when we're discussing how slowly, to give people an example of what you mean.
Well, a not bad example, if in doubt, is 10% a week for 10 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Reducing it 10% of the total dose.
Each week for 10 weeks until you're off is not a bad thumbnail if you've been on for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You'll certainly avoid your worst disasters from drug withdrawal, the physical disasters, if you come off that slowly. So that's not a bad thumbnail. In addition, you should be in charge of it. And that's why we wrote this book as much as anything, is you should be in charge of your withdrawal. You should be talking to the professional person about how you're feeling during withdrawal. I can't tell you how many times doctors in anger say, okay, you don't want the drug, we'll take you off. And they really do that in their frustration and anger that the patient isn't listening. You should be in charge. You should be able to say, no, I want to cut back. I want to do it slow. Write me a prescription for smaller pills. Tell me whether I can break these pills in half. And let's work out a program to come off. So if you've been on drugs for years, you need a program to come off.
Okay. I might also mention that there are things nutritionally you can do as well, like supporting the liver with nutrients and supplements and things. And also, it's going to be tempting, I think, when you withdraw from a drug to start using stimulants and sugar and things that are also
right.
Produce the same kind of opiate effect, drug-like effect. And it's probably not a good idea. And there's also a lot of research using actual amino acids to blunt addictive response, you know, amino acids like glutamine, which can help with addictive response to things that have an opiate effect. So there are things to do. Peter Bragan, again, your website is?
It's Bragan.com, www.bragan.com, Bregin.
And again, we've been talking to Peter Bragan, who co-authored this book, Your Drug May Be Your Problem, How and Why to Stop Taking Psychiatric Medications. His co-author is David Cohen, PhD. I was negligent in not mentioning him at the top. Thank you very much for taking the time to spend this much, you know, to tell us so much about this process. It's been a big help for those people who may be in trouble.
And thanks for the intelligent conversation, Lane. It's a pleasure to be in dialogue with you.
Oh, how sweet. Okay, we'll do it again.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Bragan.
Bye-bye.
If you missed part of today's show and you want to get a cassette copy of it, or if you need information about your own health and fitness, You can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-773-4727. That's 707-773-4727. You can also get a list of available shows on the internet. Delete www and type in members.aol.com/YOHAF, the initials of the show, Your Own Health and Fitness, YOHAF. For a list of shows on paper, you can send me a self-addressed, double-stamped, business-sized envelope to P.O. Box 2714, Petaluma, California, 94953. Next week, I'll be back with one of my monthly solo shows. This one is about nutritional strategies for dealing with stress, kind of a peel-off from this show. I'm Lena Berman. This has been Your Own Health and Fitness, produced live in the studios of listener-sponsored Free Speech Radio, May It Live Forever, KPFA FM in Berkeley, California. See you next week.